I believe we have our next guest on the line. Is this Colonel Cuculo?
Yes, it is, Pat. Thank you for having me on.
Welcome to Freedom Radio. Folks can find more, can find out more about you by going to InsideGitmo.com.
That's correct.
And Inside Gitmo happens to be the name of your new book coming out next week.
That's true. It's Inside Gitmo, the true story behind the myths of Guantanamo Bay, and HarperCollins is publishing it. I had the opportunity to go to Guantanamo, and when I came back, I was quite taken by the reality of the situation as I saw it on the ground and the soldiers, the men and women that I spoke to down there, and decided that there really needed to be something that was told to the American public that was different from what we were reading primarily in most of the media and we're hearing from some of the politicians. And so, much to my surprise, I thought it would be a 6 or 8 month project. It turned into about a 3.5 year project with five visits to the island and visits to Washington, D.C., where I had the opportunity to interview serving and former government officials, and then tons and tons of research because, as the listeners know, there's been quite a bit of information, good and bad, published about the facility. And so we wanted to dig all that out, including governmental reports from the Department of Defense and Federal Bureau of Investigation. And it turned into be a lengthy project, but now that it's done, I feel like it really is something that I'm pleased and proud to have put that much time into, because if nothing else, Pat, what it does is point out that the service members there, the men and women who are working there, are working under impossible conditions and really deserve our thanks and gratitude.
If you could tell us a little bit more about the experiences of the men and women working there, working at Gitmo.
I think it's maybe, in my opinion, and you know, I contrast this to my own experience in Vietnam and El Salvador in combat situations, and also this past spring I was able to do a month in Iraq embedded with U.S. forces over there. And, you know, as a combat vet, one of the nice things you have is the ability to shoot back, or at least, you know, if things get really bad, you can always give the enemy the finger. And these poor kids at Guantanamo are undergoing what I consider not only a thankless job, but one of the more difficult that I could imagine. They have to literally service these detainees on a 24/7 basis. They pull 12-hour shifts, which, you know, being in the military, that means you get there a couple hours early and you get to stay a couple hours late. They work six days a week.
So if they're awake, they're working.
Pretty much so, and if they're not working, they're training, because, you know, normal training requirements have to be met, so it's a extraordinarily stressful schedule. While they're on the blocks, they are assaulted by the detainees on average of 450 times. There's 450 incidents annually. This involves everything from the verbal assaults, which include racial epithets, the most vile profanity, because many of these men are highly educated and speak English with almost native proficiency, and descends down the levels into physical attacks where arms are broken, eyes are attempted to be gouged out, they get punched, they get regularly doused with what they euphemistically call a cocktail, which is something the detainees make out of feces, urine, semen, spit, vomit, and pull their hair out and stuff it in there. And when they get hit with these things, usually the detainee calls them over close and asks for something and tries to get it in their face. They're trying to get it into their mouth, eyes, nose, and ears. And when this happens, and as I said, it happens with alarming frequency, they immediately leave the block, they clean themselves up, they go over to the medic and report it so that they can find out if the individual concerned had anything that might be contagious, and they're given the day off, except that what happens is almost all of them change into a clean uniform, come back on the block, and I ask them, why do you do that? And they said, because we don't want to leave our buddies having to do our job. We'll come back and do our job. I just feel like it's a position in which you're in a you're in a virtual combat zone, but only one side gets to attack, and the other side just has to stand there and take it. You can't lash out. In the Times, for example, there was an incident where a detainee was being removed from the cell. He attacked a guard. He actually sank his teeth into the guard's face. Another guard standing nearby struck the detainee on the head with a handheld radio to try to get him off. Mm. He got him off all right, but then because he wasn't supposed to have struck a detainee, he was disciplined and reduced in rank a grade, which I found, frankly, unacceptable. It's not something I would have done if I had been a commander, but I understand the pressures that they're under down there. So,
well, what could he have done to stop it?
Really nothing. I mean, he had to do that. Otherwise, this guy would have taken a chunk out of his face. There's been multiple cases of females being struck, especially. They seem to like to go after the women. They usually refer to them on the blocks as, they'll call them infidel whores and this sort of thing, and that's probably as good as it gets. One detainee was in the dispensary being treated, and no provocation at all, he struck the nurse in the face, broke her nose all over her face, and then she left to get treatment. And he turned around to the others and he said, this infidel whore's blood has defiled my clothes. Give me clean clothes. On another instance, a young female medic who was about 19, 20 years old had been working with the detainee for some time, and he called her over to his cell. She was doing her rounds on the block. And she said, "Can I help you?" And he said, "Well, it's embarrassing. I need to just whisper it to you." And as she leaned her head down, he reached out, grabbed her face, and smashed her face repeatedly against the bars. She's had 16 reconstructive plastic surgeries at this point.
Oh.
So the stuff that our soldiers and sailors have to endure down there is unimaginable to us. I mean, I probably would last 10 seconds out there, and I'd be up for a court-martial. But and this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, this goes on daily, and yet, they swallow this frustration, they internalize it, they walk back on the block, they show up every day, they do their jobs, and then they get to read in the paper about how they're torturing and abusing the prisoners, how they're no better than Pol Pot or Hitler's SS. And that primarily for me, Pat and Tim, was one of the motivations that I had to write this book, because I felt like when I went down there, I was concerned, because it's like everybody else. I heard the rumors and I was saying, wow, is this my military? Could it really have degenerated into this? And then when I went down there and found the truth, I said, nobody's going to tell this, and it's up to me to tell the story, because I think that these service members ought to be accorded the respect and the appreciation that they deserve for candidly doing a job that none of us would consider for a moment. The kinds of people that make up your audience and the kinds of people that are ordinary Americans, they really need to know this. They shouldn't be ashamed of what's going on down there. They ought to be proud of it, because it's number one, it's never been done before in history. We've never had a detention interrogation facility like this in history. We've never really had to. We've always been in combat with other nation states where we've had fairly accepted rules of war, and even with war crimes, which were typical in World War II and among some of our enemies, for the most part, the POWs we had were manageable and behaved decently. What we've got here, though, is we're not fighting a nation. We're fighting an ideological movement that is sworn to destroy us. And so for these men, what they think is, and their behavior reflects this, is that they simply have transferred the jihad from the deserts of Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, wherever, to southeastern Cuba. They're fighting the jihad in Guantanamo, and we need to be aware of that. I mean, this place is a battleground. It's a constant stress point for the soldiers and sailors who are down there. And at the very least, I'd like someone to speak for them, and I guess that's, I'm sort of the self-appointed spokesman. But more than that, what I really want is for the public to become aware of the truth that's going on down there, and the ramifications that are associated with closure, because right now that's almost a, you know, for sure a done deal. And yet plans are out there to relocate a lot of these guys into the United States, you know, and Pendleton at Southern California is a potential place. Charleston, South Carolina, Leavenworth, Kansas, and they're getting bipartisan political pushback on that. I mean, even, you know, Governor Sebelius of Kansas, who's a strong Obama supporter, is saying, not in my backyard. And the people there are just stunned that, you know, all of a sudden we might end up with 250 plus of these guys, in a neighborhood near us, and that we know. I mean, this is something we've observed since 2001 in Afghanistan, and then later in Iraq. We've seen it in Yemen, where wherever we house these people becomes a magnet for suicide bombers, for other terrorists. They don't care if they actually.
Still obviously nuts. It's hard to comprehend.
Well, not only that, but one federal judge in Washington, D.C. has actually ordered 17 of the Chinese Uyghurs who are down in Guantanamo released, just outright released, half of them into the Northern Virginia area, the other half into Tallahassee, Florida. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, you know, I read a piece this morning where one of the legal team is talking about, we'll just try the ones we can try and everybody else will release them here. I mean, what are we going to do, give them green cards? We keep professionals out of this country and make them wait for years, and we're going to take committed jihadists, committed Islamic terrorists, and let them go just because we have, it makes us feel good? This is insanity. And yet there's serious people thinking about this on a national level. So that's why I think it's so important that we get grassroots excitement about this. Now, you know, yes, let's thank and appreciate the soldiers, but at the same time, let's be aware that this is a ticking time bomb that could explode in our faces if we're quiet about it. You know, there's a reason that President Bush did not extend Geneva rights to these people, even though the treatment that they're getting far exceeds anything called for by Geneva. And I think that's an important point to make, because what even back to the days of the early 80s of the Soviet Empire, there was a move afoot to have Geneva modified. It was called Protocol 1, so that it would include these, quote, wars of national liberation, which basically are these bandits, guerrillas, and terrorists who roam the world without uniforms, with no regard for the law of land warfare, with no chain of command. They don't carry weapons openly, and they commit war crimes. By all of those standards, Geneva rejects them as prisoners of war, mm-hmm. and does not afford, you know, because the whole purpose for Geneva was to protect civilians, to protect the innocents. These people make war on the innocents, and so quite correctly, even though we're giving them Geneva Plus treatment, if you will, to extend officially Geneva protection to them would be a travesty and would fly in the face of what the what the signers of that convention expected, and would be certainly outside of the spirit of the convention. So I think there's a lot here, because when the anti-Gitmo people say things like, oh, well, they don't even get Geneva Convention protection, that's a good thing, because we're protecting the Geneva Convention for what it is.
Right.
What they don't say is they're getting a whole heck of a lot better than Geneva, and they're certainly getting anything better than any American prisoner has ever received in any war. What makes me very happy about Gitmo is that we haven't had any of these escapes that we've seen from places like Afghanistan or Iraq. There have been no prison escapes. It's fairly easy to protect. Even the Cubans, who are a long way from being friends, have told the command informally, look, we don't want these guys either. If they get out of here, we're turning them over to you. We don't want any part of this. And so that's just sort of a deal that they cut between themselves there. But I think it's very pertinent to realize that we're in a position where we simply have to be able to continue with Guantanamo. And failing that, we have to be prepared to accept some very unpleasant potential consequences.
You know, I would like to ask what a day is like for those that are interned there. I mean, what their schedule is like.
Pretty much the, you know, they get 5 calls for prayer a day. Typically, a lot of them won't believe that the Americans are telling them the truth on the time, so they'll have their own imams, their own self-appointed imams in the different prison blocks will do the call for prayer. Every cell, every block, every rec area has an arrow painted on the floor pointing in the direction of Mecca. So they all have their Quran, their prayer rug, prayer oils, and beads. They have the full prayer kit, so they'll pray. Not all of them do, by the way, but it's strictly voluntary. In order not to disturb the prayer, the detainees have asked, and the command has granted them, that they'll put these little orange traffic cones out in the hallway so the guards will tiptoe around and keep their voices low because, you know, goodness sakes, we don't want to disturb the detainees' prayers. They'll get the first of 3 full meals a day. They eat. They're offered 4,200 calorie meals a day or total daily. And so many of them are actually getting fat, even though they came from the battlefield in malnutrition condition. The meals are halal, which means that they're, prepared in accordance with Islamic requirements. All that has to be flown in, by the way, because there's not a halal facility on the island. On special Muslim feast days like Eid at the end of Ramadan, they're afforded a really terrific feast. It costs, by the way, $34 a day to feed a detainee at Guantanamo. It costs $17 a day to feed an American soldier in combat. So it's a 2-to-1 ratio that we're spending on these guys on food alone. The average detainee can go on sick call every day and can, or really at any time. They see a medical personnel on average 4 times a month, and contrast that with the average American male of the same age who sees a doctor maybe 3.5 times a year. They have access to a 20,000-plus volume library, and they bring the books around to them. They like to deface the books and to send messages to each other on them, so the books have to be replaced fairly frequently. Harry Potter is a big favorite of them. And there's some moderate Muslim works that are in there also. Those who are illiterate receive language training, both in the vernacular, and if they want to opt for it, they can get English language training. Depending on where they are and what their status is as far as behavior, they can be given almost unlimited outside recreational privileges, as in Camp 4, or several hours a day in some of the other camps, or they can be withdrawn if they misbehave by attacking the guards, throwing one of those cocktails on them, something like that.
Yeah.
They get special meals if they are in any kind of medical condition. For example, they might have more calcium, some more potassium, low sodium, extra this. They don't like the carrots touching the meat, so that has to be put in there just right. They may be allergic to something. If they want extra portions, they can have that. They'll do their 5 times daily prayer. They may be called on for interrogation. No one is ever forced to go to interrogation, as the head of the interrogation center told me. If we got to drag them in there, we're not going to get anything out of them anyway. I've seen multiple interrogations. Basically, they sit in a love seat or a easy chair, a lazy boy. And they have a conversation. And typically the interrogators, many of them are women, will either bake something or bring something from the McDonald's or Dunkin' Donuts or something in for them to eat. So or show them movies. So it's, it's not 24 where Jack Bauer is pulling fingernails and bending, breaking wrists and slapping guys around. Well, a lot of them, too, on the hunger strike, when they first went on it, they were the detainees were calling the shots, and they were being coached by their U.S. attorneys, their U.S. and British attorneys, who were telling them, take 1,000 calories, that's all. It'll keep you alive, but you'll look like you're starving to death. And so they were feeding them Ensure at that time and were, you know, catering to them. They'd rub their feet in the hospital and all this kind of stuff. And then finally, the detention group commander, an MP colonel by the name of Michael Baumgartner, who turned out, he and I turned out to be close friends, and he's the one who actually helped me get to Iraq. Baumgartner finally said, "Down with this. You know, they're not running this place. We are. And, you know, they all want to look like they're barely alive and everything. Well, you know, forget about that." So they got federal prison system advisors in and said, "How do we do this?" And they said, "Well, here's how you do it. You know, you don't let them dictate. You dictate. Here's how many calories, the human body can accept over a period of time." And so suddenly, this was when it peaked in I guess, 2005 for the September 11th anniversary, and there were about 131 of these guys. And they began to pump, you know, 2,500, 3,000 calories a day into them, and then they began to look good. You know, the pink came back in their cheeks, and they were starting to put on weight. And most of them said, "To hell with it. Why hunger strike? If I'm gaining weight, I might as well enjoy eating." And so they went off of it, but for a few, you know, really hardcore guys. And so, you know, we took it that way and took it out of their hands because it was kind of ridiculous the way it was going, and the command recognized that.
But that was torture, right?
Oh, well, you know, one interesting thing, because what you read about, you know, let's talk about the hunger strikes for a second. What you read about everywhere is, and the European activists have been primarily responsible for this, about how tubes the size of garden hoses are forced down their nose, and soldiers do it, and then they yank the tubes out, and they're bloody, and they stick them in another person's nose. Well, you know, it's absurd. They use 3-millimeter diameter tubes. And I saw racks of these things in sterile containers. No soldier or sailor touches the detainee to put this on. It's all done by medical personnel. One tube, obviously, per feeding, then they toss it. And at one point, the commander who was there when I was last there, Admiral Harry Harris, who's an amazing guy, when he came in, he said, "Okay, do it to me." So they said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "I want to be tube fed, so I know what it's like when I talk to the media." So they did it to him. Many of these law firms are working for unnamed Saudi, Bahraini, or other Gulf state countries that are pouring hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of dollars into the defense to twist our legal system against ourselves. Same way they've done in the UK. And the other aspect of this is that by having these people brought to this country raises the level of violence so high that it's going to bring even borderline Muslims in this country or infiltrators from, you know, from, say, Venezuela, where they're training Hezbollah, up through this country to make some sort of statement. And that's going to be suicide bombings, attacks on the facilities, and attacks on the installation. I mean, one of the things we've been doing since Leavenworth was named is researching Leavenworth. Well, my God, yeah. We found out that the only hospital facility, and remember what I said earlier, that these guys typically see medical personnel four times a month. The only hospital there that can accommodate them is in the city of Leavenworth itself, and it's located adjacent to an elementary school. Mm-hmm. Now, if we're talking about 4 months times 250, you know, you do the math. We did, and it turns out it's like 30 round trip visits daily. With that kind of exposure, I mean, even the Keystone cops could mount an attack or something on that. And they're right next to an elementary school. We've seen what these guys did the Chechens did in Brezin. How would we like, you know, if you had kids going to school in Leavenworth, Kansas, and you knew that these terrorists were being ferried back and forth to the hospital every day, I mean, I'd have to take my kids out of school. I don't think I could stand the stress.
No.
These are real questions, and they're real people. And suddenly, in what I think is going to be the minds of many fence sitters in America, or people who just, you know, haven't really been engaged in the debate because they felt like it was something distant, suddenly it's not way down there in Cuba anymore. It's right in my backyard. And you know how mobile our society is. I mean, an escapee in Leavenworth could be in New York City in a day.
Or in
Minneapolis or anywhere, you know, or Detroit, and go underground in the communities there, and suddenly we've got a full-fledged, high-ranking al-Qaeda operative who's working in our midst.
With tradecraft for how to falsify documents, identification documents.
The whole nine yards. I mean, some of these guys down there, we're not talking about a stupid bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of what the attorneys have been trying to say for a long time, too, to Tim's point, is that a lot of these are, you know, oh, poor, simple opium farmers or peasants who were drafted in by the Taliban. We've got two guys down there who have advanced degrees from the London School of Economics. We've got a master's degree in electrical engineering, the hardest discipline, from Purdue. There's two pharmacists, one physician. A number have graduated from Emory-Riddle University in Arizona and in Florida, where they learned how to fly airplanes. And one thing that the interrogation command did down there that was very interesting about a year ago was that they profiled the 9/11 hijackers. They profiled Mohammed al-Qahtani, who's a self-identified 20th hijacker in Gitmo, profiled Zacharias Moussaoui. And then he said, okay, take these profiles and run them against the guys that we have down here. And they came up with about between 4 and 5 of what he calls fantasy hijack teams, qualified pilots and muscle men who had just come out of the training camps in Afghanistan. And lo and behold, all of those guys were in the United States in 9/11. You know, I just urge the listeners to get informed about this, because this is a critical subject. And, you know, go to the website, order the book, and get smart about it, because it's no longer a theoretical issue. It's something that's going to affect us all.
God bless us all. And God bless America, and thank you, sir.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Tim. Good night.
Good evening.